Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Michio Kaku. I want to talk with him about taking pictures of your dreams. That's fascinating. We'll get into all of that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Michio Kaku, with us. So, Michio, first of all, for the tour that you're going to take, the pretty extensive book tour, can people get that information off your website?
That's right. You can go to mkaku.org, mkaku.org. Or go to my Facebook site. We've logged 1.5 million fans on my Facebook site at Michio Kaku, M-I-C-H-I-O-K-A-K-U. And the 12-city book tour is listed.
Super. Now, before we take calls, you got to tell me about taking pictures of our dreams. And when you say you've seen it, what does it look like?
Well, here's how it works. You put the sleeping person into an MRI machine, which scans the brain and creates a series of dots, 30,000 dots, representing the electrical activity in all parts of the living brain. Then a computer program scans all 30,000 dots, and then over time, it learns how to create a picture, a picture of what you are looking at. Now, I've seen these pictures. You see a picture, for example, of a giraffe, of a mouse, of a human being, and they are fuzzy. But you can tell that it is an elephant you're looking at, and you can see the eyes, noses, ears of a human being. Now, remember, that's just 30,000 dots. A typical picture may have 1 million pixels, and so we have a long ways to go, but it's only a matter of time before we increase the resolution. Now what happens is the person falls asleep and goes into this machine, scans the visual cortex, which is at the back of the brain, and then constructs an approximation to what you are dreaming about. And using this method, you can then start to tear apart the lore or verify the mythology of sleep. For example, lucid dreaming. It was once thought that lucid dreamers who are conscious while they dream was fake. Take a look at the movie Inception with Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. But in Germany, at the Max Planck Institute, they put a lucid dreamer in an MRI scan, scanned him while he was dreaming. And they realize it's really true. You can be conscious while you dream. That in the dream, you can say to yourself, I am dreaming. I'm going to change the direction of the dream. This has now been measured in the laboratory. And so this is going to create a huge breakthrough, a golden age of understanding dreams, not from the point of view of hearsay and storytelling, but from the point of view of hard science, by looking at the MRI images of people who are dreaming. So one day you may wake up, hit the play button of a computer, and watch the dream you had last night.
I love this. Now, if people are very good at the being clairvoyant and they dream of events that haven't happened yet, would we still be able to get pictures of that? Case in point, somebody who had that precognition dream of 9/11 and maybe saw these towers getting hit by a plane or something. Would they still be able to do that?
Well, whatever you are dreaming about, as long as it can be scanned using an MRI machine, the software will convert it into a picture. Amazing. Whether you're thinking about something that is nonsensical or something that is real, whatever the brain is visually imaging, the computer will have a reasonable approximation of this. And this is being done at the University of California at Berkeley. This is not an amateur in the basement doing this. You're talking about high-tech people, professors at Berkeley, who are seriously looking at how to image what you are looking at. In other words, a picture of your thoughts.
I love this. This is fantastic. And 10 years from now, it could be incredible.
That's right. We're going to increase the number of pixels from 30,000 to eventually millions. So we'll have a much better picture, literally a picture, of what you are looking at.
Well, we've seen what they've done with digital cameras. When they first came out, they didn't have a lot of pixels. Now they're great, and they're getting even better. I guess dreams could be the same way.
That's right. So a lot of the lore around dreaming is now being deciphered. And in fact, in the movie Inception, not only do you dream, you also enter the dream and actually change the course of the dream. This may also be a possibility. If you have this brain scan and you hook this image up to a PC, then a second person can see the PC and see what you are dreaming. And then you can put the image of yourself looking at the PC into the mind of the person who's dreaming. In other words, Leonardo DiCaprio suddenly appears in your dream. And so in the book, I give you the blueprints of how one day, not today, but one day, we might be able to literally enter somebody else's dream, because lucid dreaming is no longer science fiction. We use MRI scans to prove that people could be lucid dreamers. By the way, in Buddhist texts, this goes back hundreds of years, there are lessons that you have to train yourself to become a lucid dreamer. For example, just before you dream, you have a notebook recording the dream you're going to have, and you prepare yourself for lucid dreaming. And so this is something that even the average person can learn.
Now, what if it's not a dream, but it's a thought? Would they still be able to capture a picture from a thought? Because where I'm heading with this, Michio, is let's assume we use it as a lie detector and we hook somebody up and say, you know, did you commit that murder, for example? And they say, no, not at all. Yet their brain has a picture of exactly what they did, and the picture unfolds. The computer literally prints out this person committing this heinous crime. Could they do it like that?
Well, it's conceivable. Right now, the pictures are hazy. However, as I said, we're going to have more and more pixels, more and more resolution. And however, you have to ask yourself then an ethical question. If a person is thinking about a crime, is that person guilty if he hasn't actually committed that crime yet? And so we're going to get into the fuzzy area that the movie with Tom Cruise, where he Minority Report goes into that. The question is, what happens if you could read people's minds and see the intention of doing something? Now, MRI lie detectors already exist. They're not 100% perfect, but here's how they work. When you tell a lie, you have to first know the truth. Then you have to create the lie. Then you have to calculate the consistency of the lie with all the other lies you've been telling all these years. That's a lot of brain power. Your brain lights up like a Christmas tree. However, your brain will also light up like a Christmas tree if you're anxious. So maybe it's not that you're telling a lie. Maybe you're sweating because you're in an MRI machine having your brain scanned. So it's not foolproof, but it is one way to see whether or not you're lying. If you saw the movie Salt with Angelina Jolie, there's a scene in that movie where they take the Russian spy and they put him in an MRI machine. And they actually scan his brain using this lie detector to see whether or not the CIA can detect whether a person is lying or not. So, yeah, perhaps it already exists behind closed doors.
Let's go to the phones. Jason is truck driving in Tennessee on the Wildcard Line. Welcome to the show, Jason.
How you guys doing tonight?
Good. Thank you.
I have a question for Mr. Kapoor. I have a, I guess you would call an OCD problem, where I think on several levels at the same time, where, say, problematic solving. I will play out scenarios, several to hundreds of them, at the same time with minute, you know, with the most minute details in them, and still be concentrating on driving my truck or loading cars or, you know, having a conversation with someone else. Why is that happening? You know, everybody tell me, you know, you need to go see someone about that, but I don't think it's a problem. I think it's like an overactive process, so to speak.
Well, we can actually brain scan people with OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. For example, these people compulsively wash their hands and actually see how it works in the brain. You see, you have your hands, you feel they're dirty, and then you go and wash them, and then you're satisfied that your hands are clean. That's a three-step process. It turns out that in people with OCD, the third step is missing. So they feel that something's wrong with their hands. They wash their hands, but the sense of satisfaction, the sense of relief, is missing. And they still think that something is wrong with their hands, and they go and wash it again. So we think that this feedback loop, that we do something, we're satisfied, and we stop, the feedback loop loses one part of the cycle, and so you start the cycle over and over and over again. Now, with brain scans, we can actually see this. This is no longer just an imaginary scenario worked out by some psychiatrist. This is hard physics. that we can actually see that certain obsessive behaviors is because this loop is not yet closed. Now, there are certain drugs that people have taken that apparently can help to assuage some of the symptoms of OCD. But again, right now, we're still children when it comes to understanding mental illness and understanding the quirks of the brain. Sometimes people who are perfectly normal, exhibit some of these behaviors.
There's a Nobel Prize here for science somewhere, I think, Michio, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere deep within the brain, someone's going to come up with some more innovative things here. It's really fascinating. Pam is in Norman, Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Pam. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi, Pam.
To you before.
Go ahead, Pam.
I had a dream that you said you thought that it was weird that you could keep on spelling your name G-E-O-R-G-E-O-R-G-E-O-R like that forever.
You dreamt that?
Yeah, I did. I dreamed you said it on Coast, like that you had just figured that out, and it freaked you out because it kept going over and over in your head like that, and you couldn't get rid of it.
That's a nightmare.
Maybe the professor could help you with it.
Well, George, you know, we have brain scanned people who are dreaming, and we see something very interesting with the brain scan. That first of all, the frontal cortex behind your forehead, that's where you are located, that's basically shut down when you sleep, so you have no sense of who you are. Your orbital frontal cortex right behind your eyes, your fact checker is turned off. And so the laws of physics are suspended. You can float in midair. You can assume different identities because these parts of the brain are basically shut down. But the center of the brain, the amygdala, which has emotions and mainly fear, that is activated. And that's why we have nightmares. And that's why some dreams are unpleasant, because the amygdala does regulate fear and tension, while the logical centers of the brain are basically shut down. And so you can see how this happens. Now you can also take a look at out-of-body experiences. These people have also been brain scanned. It turns out that people who float and have out-of-body experiences, they have the sensation of floating, so their visual and tactile senses are confused. So if you take their brain and you stimulate the juncture between these two senses, the sense of where you are and the sense of your eyesight, then the brain gets confused because it's getting signals from both sides of this dividing line on your brain. And you can actually induce out-of-body experiences, just like a light switch. Just like a light switch, you can turn it on. You can actually hit this area with an electrode, and the person leaves his body. And you turn it off, and the person goes back into his body like a light switch. So this is amazing. We can actually see some of the quirkiness of the brain at the level of probes directly on the cortex.
All right, let's go back to Pam and Norman. Pam, you had a question. Go ahead.
Well, this brings up the question of if you took a blind person's brain when they were dreaming like me, since I don't look at pictures when I'm dreaming, I just do sounds mostly and feelings, how would that look in the picture? And my original question was, I frustrate myself with depression and sleep disorder. I don't see light and dark, so I don't go to sleep very easily. And that makes you depressed after weeks and weeks of it. And, you know, it's kind of a challenging situation. But have they mapped brains about depression and things like that besides bipolar?
Okay, let me try to address a number of these things. First of all, there are people who are clinically depressed who have resisted every sort of psychotherapy and counseling. For these individuals, we've scanned their brain, and we find a certain area of the brain that's overactive, a very tiny part of the brain that's overactive, and probes placed right into the brain that neutralize this area, cure them of depression. There's even videotapes of people saying that they're depressed, they want to die, it's horrible all their lives, they've been oppressed by this, nothing works. And then the next instant, they're cheerful. And it's as if a huge mountain has been lifted right off their chest. And it's amazing, these videotapes, watching the before and after. And also with Parkinson's, we know that Michael J. Fox, of course, is afflicted with Parkinson's that makes your hands jitter. You can actually see that there's a certain part of the brain that's overactive. And again, by putting these probes directly to that part of the brain and neutralizing it, these people no longer have tremors. Now, this is not for everyone, but I'm just mentioning the fact that there are ways in which we can actually neutralize overactive areas of the brain and cure people of afflictions that they've had since childhood.
That is just amazing, the things that could be done. Let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut, the amateur astronomer. Hey, Bill, go ahead.
Yes, hi, George. Yes, Dr. Kako, I'm also an atheist as well as an amateur astronomer, so I don't agree with the idea of a soul. I would call it mind or consciousness in relation to the brain. And my question to you is about NDEs, near-death experiences, because you mentioned out-of-body experiences a few minutes ago, and this is similar. Everybody who has been on Coast to Coast who has NDEs, particularly Danion Brinkley, who George knows well, talks about something, at least one thing that I can understand regarding NDEs, life review, where they review everything or almost everything in their life, as well as every interaction they've had in their life with other people, as well as the perspective and the thoughts and the feelings of everybody else that they've talked to or related to in their lives. How is that possible, and what part of the brain is involved in that?
Well, the United States Air Force was interested in this because pilots undergo enormous G-forces when they make a turn, and some of them black out, which is fatal if you're a jet pilot. So they invited a psychiatrist to come by and witness pilots in an ultracentrifuge. By tuning the speed of the ultracentrifuge, you can place pilots just at the borderline of being conscious and unconscious. Blood drains from the top of their brain, and the eyesight is affected. The peripheral vision, the outside of your peripheral vision, loses blood first. And so you see a tunnel because your peripheral vision no longer has that much blood. And so all the light is concentrated toward the forward direction, and you see a tunnel with the light at the end. Not only this, but you can fine-tune it. You can fine-tune it so that you can, one direction, the person blacks out. In the other direction, the person goes back to normal. But right in between, you can see the light at the end of the tunnel. Now, this, of course, was a matter of life and death for the Air Force, because pilots, you want to make sure that they don't go unconscious in a sharp turn. But this also has implications, therefore, of people who are in accidents. Oxygen deprivation will also do this. People that have carbon dioxide too much in their system will also have this behavior. And so there are many situations where the peripheral vision starts to become impaired, which gives you the illusion that you see a light at the end of the tunnel. Now, whether this has to do with near-death experiences, I don't know. All the Air Force wanted to know was what happens in that shadow world when you are conscious and unconscious. And what we see is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Hold on, Michio. We're coming back for more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, next hour, we're talking about the ghost rockets with Micah Hanks. You're going to love that story. But when we come back with Michio Kaku, author of many books and works, including The Future of the Mind, we will take final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Michio Kaku with us. Michio, what is the caveman principle that you talk about?
Well, you know, some predictions simply don't come true, like the paperless office. We have more paper than before. And also the peopleless city. Some people predicted that cities will empty out, will all teleconference, and commuting will come to a halt. However, we have more paper than before. We have more commuting than before. Cities are much bigger than before. So what went wrong? What went wrong is the caveman principle, that our personality has not changed for about 100,000 years since we emerged from Africa, and we still have all the same instincts. We are hunters, and we like proof of the kill. You just can't boast that you almost got the buffalo. You want to have proof, and that's why we like paper. Paper is proof of the kill. We like hard copy to show that we have done something rather than trusting electrons dancing on a computer screen that disappear when you hit the off button. And we also hunt in packs. We are social animals, And that's why we like to bond with each other. And that's why commuting in cities are even bigger than before. And so whenever we have a conflict between high tech and high touch, we will take high touch every time. If I give you the choice of live tickets to your favorite rock and roll band or a videotape of your favorite rock and roll band, which will you choose? The videotape is superior. The videotape has everything from all angles. You know, your seat could be way in the back. But what are you going to choose? You'll choose live tickets because you want boasting rights. You want to say, I have communed with my rock star guru. And so we are still the cavemen of 100,000 years ago. And also, what did we do after the hunt? After the hunt, we danced around the campfire. We told jokes. We got drunk. We flirted with each other. And what is that? That is Facebook. Facebook is the campfire in cyberspace, multiplied by several billion times. We dance, we get drunk, we flirt, everything that our ancestors did at the campfire so many years ago. So the lesson is, if you have a high-tech device that will make you a millionaire, do not go up against the caveman principle, because it's not going to sell. For example, look at the picture phone. During the World's Fair in the 1960s, AT&T spent about $300 million perfecting the picture phone, and they sold only 300 of them. That's $1 million a phone. Now, why is that? You see, we are hunters. We like to look at other people. We do not like to be looked at. If you don't believe me, get into an elevator and stare at somebody for about 7 seconds. Just stare at them for seven seconds.
They can't handle it.
In 10 seconds, you're going to get a black eye.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is a testable phenomenon. We do not like to be hunted. We are the hunter. We like to watch television for hours. But if somebody videotapes you without your permission, you get creepy.
That's right. So
that's the caveman principle at work.
I love that. Okay, let's go to Michelle in Oakland, California. Hey, Michelle, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I'm honored to be on the phone with both of you. Before I ask my questions, I want to say that I'd like to volunteer for any of those brain downloads as soon as you find out that they're safe.
You're in.
But let's see. I wanted to know, my first question is there a limit to how much we can actually store in our brain? Does it ever get too full to stop taking input?
Well, you know, I thought so until I started to do research. And then I came up against these savants like Kim Peek. Kim Peek could memorize 15,000 books. He knew line for line exactly what was on each book. And when he read these books, he read them 2 pages at a time. When was the last time you read a book 2 pages at a time? Well, we scanned his brain. He has since passed away, but we scanned his brain, and we found out that the left and right hemispheres were separated. So that's how he could read 2 pages at the same time. But where did he store all this information? We don't know. We think, but we cannot prove yet, that the brain does record, but also it erases. And the erase mechanism of a tape recorder is intact. But in these brains, it goes haywire. They don't erase. They keep on memorizing new material. And the amount of information that they store is phenomenal. One woman in Los Angeles, for example, has been recorded at length by scientists. She says that her memory is like a split screen. One screen is what she actually sees. The other screen is what she was doing 30 years ago at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. She's reliving another day in her past. So we really don't know how much information the brain can store, but it is humongous. But evolution has mercifully allowed us to forget, because otherwise we'd be paralyzed. And some of these people, by the way, are marginally functional. They can barely hold a job because they're haunted by all these memories coming at them all at once.
These memories that come at people all at once. How much can the brain handle?
Yeah, that's a big mystery. We really don't know. If a man can memorize 15,000 volumes line by line, you know that's an enormous amount of material. And that was the basis of the movie Rain Man with Tom Cruise. The movie was based on the life of Kim Peek, who recently passed away.
That's right, and Dustin Hoffman, if I recall. Let's go to Miguel in San Antonio, Texas. Hello, Miguel. Thank you.
Hello, gentlemen. How y'all doing tonight?
Good, Miguel. Thank you.
Yes, doctor, I had a question. You stated before that the mind is not digital, but yet the equipment we use is digital as far as the methodology of interpreting disinformation. And much like when we try to replicate a analog signal with a digital signal, there's loss of information. So my question to you is, what do you think there is a inherent uncertainty in trying to capture this information?
You're absolutely right. You see, the brain is not a digital computer. So in the movie Matrix, Keanu Reeves had a jack put in the back of his skull to connect him to a computer. Well, it's not so simple. The brain is a neural network. It rewires itself after learning every task. And so it's not a simple digital signal of zeros and ones, zeros and ones. It's literally rewiring all the connections of the human brain. Therefore, when we talk about all these marvelous brain-machine interfaces that I mentioned before, controlling avatars and surrogates and controlling mechanical arms, you have to create a dictionary between patterns of the brain and motions of a machine. It's very painful. It's not easy. It's like learning how to drive, learning how to ride a bicycle for the first time. So, however, scientists are very patient, and they've created this dictionary that allows them to translate behaviors of the brain with activities associated with a robot or with a mechanical arm or a leg. So you're absolutely right. There's lots of information, and it is a crude process, but the architecture of the brain is quite different from the architecture of a digital computer. And so we have to do this painfully to create this dictionary.
Michio, as we earlier talked about telepathy and telekinetic powers, moving objects, realistically, do you think we're going to be able to get to that point with chips in our heads?
Yeah, I think very soon. In the future, we'll walk into a room. We'll telepathically control all the chips in the walls, the ceiling. We'll turn on the lights. We'll turn on the thermostat, turn on the TV. You'll get into a car, and you'll just mentally tell the car where to go, and off you go. And so we'll live in a world where the computer has literally disappeared. There will not be computers in the normal sense of the word anymore in the future. They'll be everywhere and nowhere. You'll simply mentally control them. You'll move objects. You'll telepathically give commands. And we'll take it for granted. And our grandkids will wonder, how could you possibly live in a world where you had a mouse? A mouse belongs in a museum, Grandpa. And so kids will just get used to the fact that they'll operate computers mentally.
We now go to Atlanta, Georgia. Arnold is with us, east of the Rockies. Arnold, you're on with Michio Kaku.
Hi, George, and honored to talk to you, Dr. Kaku.
Hey.
There's a technology I've been interested in a lot lately. It's 3D printing or 3D modeling. You know, where you can, like, if you need you want a coffee cup or something, or need a part for something around the house, you can go online and find a program and just, you have a 3D modeling computer, you can make that cup, or you can make that part in your house. I'm wondering, is this going to be a technology that's, you know, going to be really paradigm shifting, or is it just going to be like a fad among hobbyists, or only useful for a certain group of people?
Okay, I think it's going to be in between a fad and the next big thing. 3D printers already exist. They use, for example, plastic to create layer by layer a reproduction of a plastic part. And I think that Christmas will be revolutionized by this. In the future, you'll simply download an email with a blueprint of a favorite toy, and you'll simply print out the toy right in your living room. And so Christmas could be basically the exchanges of emails whereby you can print out toys. Also, bodily organs. We can print out heart tissue cell by cell using these printers to construct heart tissue. And so I think for specialized purposes, this is going to be great. If a machine part breaks down in your machine and you can't wait to order the part, you'll be able to download the blueprints and put that part right into the machine. But for mass production, that is competing against foundries and steel mills, I think it's not going to be competitive. However, for specialty products, this is going to be a lifesaver. You'll be able to literally create machine parts, Christmas toys, small items, and even parts of the body simply by pushing the play button of your 3D printer. And that's coming very fast.
What aspect of all of this, Michio, fascinates you the most?
Well, what's fascinating to me is the fact that maybe one day we could become immortal. Why do we have to die after all, right? We're beginning to unlock the secrets of the genome and perhaps extend the human lifespan genetically. But what about, preserving our thoughts and dreams and desires far beyond our years? And in science fiction, what they do is they shoot consciousness into outer space. Here's what you do. You take a disc with all the codes of a human brain, put it on a laser beam, and send it at the speed of light, at the speed of light into the heavens to a relay station. At the relay station, they download the laser beam and put your consciousness into a surrogate, a robot, where you begin to have superpowers. Now think about this. When some people talk about encountering aliens from outer space, in some sense, that's the old-fashioned way of encountering the aliens. Maybe the aliens move by light beams. Light beams whereby the information of their consciousness is encoded digitally, shot by laser beams throughout the universe, and it then energizes a relay station, which then constructs a robot, and they then start to have a superhuman body. That, to me, is the most efficient way to explore the galaxy. No more messy booster rockets. No more space accidents. No more meteorite collisions and weightlessness problems. You basically ride on a light beam. And of course, in lore, in mythology, people have talked about light beings, but hey, maybe we will become the light beings.
Maybe, maybe. A few more calls here. We'll go to Slidell, Louisiana. Malcolm's with us, first time caller. Malcolm, thank you for calling. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi there.
I was going to ask one question, but after listening to you, I'd like to say a couple of other things.
We'll do the
is
best
that okay? I'll try to do it as fast as I can.
All right, go ahead.
I've been listening to y'all since the very beginning. But anyway, can you hear me okay?
Yeah,
I can hear you.
Okay. In 86, I got crane operator job, 750-pound headache ball on my head. And I didn't sleep for a year. And then after that, every time I went to sleep, I'm still screwed up. But I sleep for 10, 15 minutes, and I go to REM sleep, and I have dreams. And all the time. You know, I don't sleep for very long. But I have all kind of dreams. And I remember them, but some are very interesting and intense. But I got so much to say about.
Well,
that.
Look, how about a quick question, Malcolm? Okay, we're almost out of time.
Okay, all right. The quick question is: right now, I have cancer. I have Adenocarcinoma.
What's your question, Malcolm? We're almost out of time.
I have lung cancer. It's stage 3. It's all in the same thing. But what can I do with my mind to help myself?
Well, now that's a tough question, Michio, isn't it?
Yeah, George, it seems to me that if a person has cancer that's advanced, then at some point you may have to say to yourself, you have to get your personal affairs in order. You have to make peace with your enemies. You have to be at peace with the world because when you want to leave the world in a better place than when we entered. And we also have to watch out for certain kinds of get-rich-quick schemes and quick cures. We know that they're going to be very few and far between miracle cures with cancer. However, if it's still operable, I mean, then, of course, there's a chance to use some of the experimental therapies that are out there, and they are incredible. We can now cure certain forms of cancer, not just hold them at bay, but actually cure them. And so if you go to my book, you can actually see some of the incredible advances being made in nanoscience. That is, we use molecules to seek out cancer cells and kill them one by one. This was once considered stuff right out of, comic books. But we do that. It's called nanomedicine. We have nanoparticles that actually home in on individual cancer cells and kill them. At Bethesda, Maryland, at the National Institutes of Health, experiments are being done on people who are terminal, people who have no hope at all. They've resisted all possible therapies. Some of them have responded very well to nanotherapy, using molecules to home and seek out and destroy individual cancer cells.
I got to tell you, I would pray to God, Mitchu, that they tackle cancer one day in our lifetime, huh? I really hope that's the case. Anyways, my friend, we are almost out of time, but I do want to, where's your first tour? Do you know where you're going?
Yeah, I'm going to Milwaukee tomorrow. And if you go to my website, mkaku.org, or my Facebook site, Michio Kaku, you can see the complete list of 12 cities that I'll be hitting, and maybe I'll be going to a city signing your copy of The Future of the Mind. I'll be going to Boston, Seattle, Chicago, Jacksonville, Kansas City, Los Angeles, Washington. You'll name it, I'll be there.
Well, maybe we'll see you when you get to Los Angeles, okay?
Okay.
All right, thanks. That's Dr. Michio Kaku, always a great guest here on Coast to Coast AM. When I come back, Micah Hanks joins us as we talk about ghost rockets right here on Coast to Coast AM. We shall be right back. Don't touch your dial.